from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, 2013 elections, Twitter IPO billionaires, a gay rights bill, and a crack-smoking mayor in Toronto. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie got a big re-election as a Republican, he said, who reaches across the aisle and who looks to Washington, maybe the White House.
I know that if we can do this in Trenton, New Jersey, maybe the folks in Washington, D.C. should tune in their TVs right now, see how it's done.
The Affordable Care Act still under fire. Last night on NBC, President Obama, who once promised if you like your plan, you can keep it, apologized to the 5% of Americans who may learn they can't.
I am sorry that they are finding themselves in this situation based on assurances they got from me.
And Twitter took shares public this week in a blockbuster IPO. The opening bell on the New York Stock Exchange rang with a sign at the podium that read, hashtag ring. And CEO Dick Costolo talked up the importance of being Twitter.
We have an absolute perspective on the long-term kind of company we want to be in service to being the public, conversational, real-time, distributed platform.
Yeah, this hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Casey Hunt of NBC News, Alexander Burns of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What lessons at the polls this week for Republicans, Democrats? What news in the latest economic numbers? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Alexander Burns, senior political reporter for Politico. Alexander Burns, Alex, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Also from Washington, Casey Hunt, reporter for NBC News. She covers politics and Congress. Casey, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
And with us in the studio, with me in the studio today, what a pleasure. Jack Beatty joins us right in front of me. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Alexander and Casey.
Let's dive straight in. Alexander Burns, what lessons in this trio of big elections? I know there's more than that, but in Christie, in McAuliffe, in de Blasio in New York, what do you see? What are the signs here, Alex?
Well, look, I think we're going to see the Republican Party having a furious debate over the next couple weeks and months and even years about what the lessons are from these elections. But certainly the biggest headline from this week has to be that Chris Christie has kind of cracked the code as a Republican for what it takes to win, and that Ken Cuccinelli, the candidate for governor in Virginia, who came up just barely short, clearly did not. There are folks down here in Virginia who say that the closeness of that campaign shows that you can campaign as a staunch, really arch conservative and come close to winning. But for a lot of folks in the party, coming close to winning is not really the goal of competing in an election. And it looks a lot better to win by 22 points, as Christie did up in New Jersey.
Casey Hunt, Alex says Chris Christie has cracked the code. If he has, and certainly he got a majority of Hispanic votes in New Jersey, he got a pretty good showing of African-American votes, and he won very handsomely. If he's cracked the code, what does his code cracking look like, Casey? What's the Christie treatment?
You're going to hear that over and over and over again from Christie and company, that he did win the Latino vote. He's already sort of out there saying, what other Republican can win the Latino vote? And that was really the focus of all of the postmortems for Republicans after 2012, was how do we expand our reach to an electorate that is changing away from us? So you're going to see him, I think, repeat that over and over again. It sounds like he was already laying the groundwork in that hour plus long press conference that he held after he won in New Jersey. But on the flip side, you're already starting to see some conservative Republicans criticize Christie in a sort of backhanded way. They're out there saying, well, he clearly demonstrated that he can win in New Jersey. You know, congratulations to Chris Christie for that. And the insinuation there is that he couldn't win in a state like Iowa, where the presidential contest kicks off and where evangelical voters and conservatives are critical. The contest, of course, then goes to New Hampshire. Sure, different story there, but then on to South Carolina, again, with a very conservative electorate. So there's already this sort of tension underneath there between the conservatives that are seen as potential 2016 candidates and Chris Christie.
The big governor out of New Jersey is certainly ready to position himself as a contender, speaking even as he won the re-election to the governorship in New Jersey to the whole country. Here he was on Tuesday night, Asbury Park, New Jersey, saying that Washington could stand to learn a lesson from him, his state.
I know that tonight, a dispirited America, angry with their dysfunctional government in Washington, yeah, looks to New Jersey to say, is what I think happening really happening? Are people really coming together?
It's a miracle, Jack, and Chris Christie's at the front of the parade. He's on the Time magazine, new cover just coming out in silhouette, the big governor of New Jersey with the kind of cheeky headline, the elephant in the room. But he is the Republican guy in the limelight right now. What do you think of this man, his message, whether he can pull the GOP together, what kind of contender he would be for the White House?
Well, you know, he's the most vivid political personality in my memory. I mean, he just has the faculty for making even outrageous statements just seem like, you know, minted common sense. His denunciation of John Boehner and his Republican colleagues last year when they were, you know, holding up Sandy Aid even for 24 hours was matchless. I mean, you couldn't come up with rhetoric that was so unsparing toward Washington paralysis.
Fired up and those big jowls shaking. He was angry. People respond well to that.
So people absolutely do. And, of course, you hear, I mean, Casey, I think, indicates that makes people in a Southern-based party or a party dominated roughly by Southern voters. The Republicans, are they comfortable with that kind of personality? We'll have to see. But it's certainly, he certainly is a phenomenon. You know, his as people in New Jersey talk about it, he was really saved by Sandy, saved by his, you know, being on
let
the
him
scene,
reach out to everybody,
reaching out,
distribute
showing
a lot of billions
compassion,
from Washington.
And you know, unique for Republicans, literally embracing President Obama. I mean, touching the flesh. And that's what people wanted to see. The irony, though, is that Sandy victims in New Jersey are unhappy with somebody, with the federal government, with the New Jersey state government, because they simply haven't been getting the aid they've been promised. One poll showed that a majority of them are very unhappy about the way things are going. And there's criticism of Governor Christie for making an ad from this federal funding. Rand Paul made the criticism, which shows his family, you know, come to New Jersey. We've survived the storm. So he's not only managed to use Sandy, but to transcend the negatives of the fallout.
So interesting that as Washington has been just at sword points on almost everything for so long here, the message coming out of these campaigns, and not just his, but also in Virginia, out of Democrat Terry McAuliffe's win there, was this word bipartisanship from the states. Here was Terry McAuliffe, had lots of backing from Democrats, from the Clintons, who he's very close to. Here he was talking about bipartisanship on the night of his victory, the new governor of Virginia.
The truth is that this election was never a choice between Democrats and Republicans. It was a choice about whether Virginia would continue the mainstream bipartisan tradition that has served us so well over the last decade.
Alexander Burns, what about the Tea Party in all this? Chris Christie says some nice things, but he really digs at them as well. Ken Cuccinelli was straight up Tea Party in Virginia up against Terry McAuliffe, came fairly close, closer than some thought, but did not win. What's the message in the intra-party conflict in the GOP for the Tea Party here?
Well, Tom, when you talk to Democrats about that race in Virginia, they say that one of the big structural advantages they had from the very beginning was that they have a party that allows their candidates to talk about bipartisanship, and the party base can still get enthusiastic about that. That Terry McAuliffe could go out and talk to Democratic audiences about working with Republicans in Richmond, and the Democrats would respond to that. He could go talk to independents, business leaders, moderate Republicans, say the same thing, and everybody would basically get on board with it. And that's the winning coalition that he had. If Ken Cuccinelli had gone to his base and talked about working with Democrats in Richmond, that would have been just a head-snapping reversal from the political persona he's cultivated.
Could not
his
do
career.
It, really.
Could not do it. Mm-hmm. Could not do it. And it's why Christie is such a unique figure in New Jersey and why I think Casey's point is very well taken about the, you know, questions about whether that message can translate nationally is, you know, is the National Republican Party open to the message that, as Christie said on Tuesday night, you've got to go into communities where you're not comfortable and talk to them. It sounds perfectly nice that, well, yes, sure, we want a candidate who will go talk to African-Americans or young people or, as in Christie's case, Hispanic voters, Asian-American voters in the suburbs. But it's another thing to actually have a candidate who will go out and maybe throw a bone to organized labor. Christie won the support of the laborers union or, as Cuccinelli pointedly did not do, you know, trim his sails on social issues.
Yeah.
And if not actually actually moderate on something like gay rights or abortion, then at least move those issues to the back burner of the campaign.
Of course, interesting to see where the heart of this debate ultimately goes before the 2016 race. You've got Bill de Blasio in New York, mayor-elect there now, with his Tale of Two Cities, big focus on inequality. Maybe if it's Christie who goes moderate, maybe the Democrats go de Blasio and we've got a new center of gravity. Here's de Blasio on election night, won in a landslide.
I've spoken throughout this campaign about a tale of two cities. That inequality, that feeling of a few doing very well, while so many flip further behind. That is the defining challenge of our times.
Casey, we've just got half a minute before the break, but if it's, let's say, Christie, and he goes a little moderate, and this de Blasio theme takes off in the Democratic Party, does the whole debate shift a little toward the left for the first time in a long time?
It certainly is a pretty stunning shift in New York City if you think about just the contrast between Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who sort of embodies exactly what de Blasio was talking about in that soundbite you just aired, the sort of contrast between the two cities of New York, one very, very wealthy, the other made up of people that de Blasio described as sort of struggling to get by. And I think you saw that visually. Bloomberg met with de Blasio at City Hall, and the semiotics were just stunning. They were very clearly far apart. So we'll see what happens next.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Elections, Twitter goes public, a gay rights bill, a crack-smoking mayor, and trans fats being shown the door. We'll look at all that. Alexander Burns is with us from Politico, Casey Hunt from NBC News, and our own Jack Beatty. We've got callers on politics. Let's go right to them. Somerville, Massachusetts. Alma's calling. Alma, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think we need to be real careful about putting too much weight on the results of one off-year election. I think in the case of Chris Christie, he really set it up so that he would look better than he is, because they had to have a special election to replace Lautenberg, who died.
Yes, for the U.S. Senate, and
yes,
he put it at a very odd time of the calendar.
Exactly, and he not only did he waste taxpayer money, which is not supposed to be what the Republicans do, but he kept the voting down because people thought he's going to win, so a lot of Democrats probably didn't bother to vote.
Yeah.
And it made him look way better, I think, than he really is.
Well, he won't be the first governor who worked the system when it comes to putting elections on the calendar, but you're quite right. He worked it to the fullest extent of the law right there. One more. Thank you, Alma. Des Moines, Iowa. Eric, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was just actually have kind of the opposite opinion.
Okay.
I mean, somebody mentioned that conservatives are already blasting Christie for not being conservative enough and not being able to win in Iowa. But we elected Barack Obama the last two elections. And if they want to put another conservative like Rick Santorum or somebody else like that, go ahead, because he's going to lose.
Well, but hang on for a second, Eric. You say we, but of course there's a couple parties in Iowa, and the Republicans in your state do have a history of considering very conservative candidates pretty strongly. What do you think among Republican Iowans the reception might be for somebody like Chris Christie talking moderation?
Well, he may have a hard time during the caucuses, but during the election, if they want to put another conservative like that, like Santorum or somebody like that, on their ballot, he's going to lose.
Well, very much on Republicans' minds, certainly. They're being reminded by people within their own ranks that in national elections, things have not gone so well for the U.S. Senate and certainly for the White House. Republicans with a lot to weigh here as we move toward a new election season. Of course, Democrats with a lot to weigh as well, particularly on the health care front, continuing difficulties with the rollout of Obamacare, with who's getting what kind of coverage, who's losing what kind of coverage. Kathleen Sebelius back in the hot seat again this week before the Senate Finance Committee. Even Democrat Bill Nelson of Florida, who was a strong supporter of the Affordable Care Act, urging her to really go after those contractors, wanted to put the blame right there and burn their fingers, punish them for the shortcomings of the rollout. Here he is.
As someone who has fought and bled for this and who sincerely thinks that it's going to work in the long run, I want you to hold them account. I want you to burn their fingers and make them pay for not being responsible and producing a product that all of us could be proud.
I want you to burn their fingers and make them. He's scary right there. John Cornyn of Texas, tough from a different angle. Very sharp critique here on the issue of what was promised about whether or not people could keep their policies and what has actually happened. Scarcely gave Sebelius a chance to answer. She didn't really want to answer on his terms anyway, but here was that exchange before the Senate Finance Committee.
The White House website says if you like your plan, you can keep it, and you don't have to change a thing due to the health care law. Well, we know that lying to Congress is a crime, but unfortunately, lying to the American people is not. I'd just like to ask you a simple true or false question. Is that statement on the White House website true, or is it false?
Sir, I think the statement is
it true or is it false, Madam Secretary?
And on and on and on, that back and forth with the former governor of Kansas there, slipping away best she could. President Obama trying to kind of concede failures even here, at the same time as he continues to assert the fundamental value of the new law. Here he was last night in an interview with NBC's Chuck Todd.
I think we, in good faith, have been trying to take on a healthcare system that has been broken for a very long time. And what we've been trying to do is to change it in the least disruptive way possible.
Well, it looks a little disruptive so far. Casey Hunt, that was your colleague Chuck Todd who got the apology from the President of the United States on the promise, clearly not kept, that nobody would have to lose their policy. But the White House is saying, well, 5% max who may be in that situation, and they'll have better health care on the other side of that loss. How's this thing unfolding, Casey? How's this working out?
Well, the challenge for the White House now, and part of why the president's argument is a very difficult one right at this moment, is because there are so many more examples of people who've had cancellations or had to change their plans than there are examples of people who have successfully signed up for the exchanges or gotten health care under this law. Now, I mean, from an economic perspective and the way that the law is written, the policy of it, the president isn't wrong. It's designed to bring uninsured Americans back into the insurance market. It's designed to make their insurance better than it was. You know, their argument is that, well, these plans people are getting kicked off of really actually are a ripoff in many cases. They're not providing people with what they need. But until they start to get sort of a groundswell of people who can step up and say, hey, this law is helping me, it's going to be a public relations nightmare. And from what you were showing earlier of that congressional hearing, I mean, one of the major problems here is that Senate Democrats, especially those who are up for re-election in the next year, are starting to turn on them. You know, a group of them went to the White House this week and basically aired all their grievances and frustrations. And it's if he starts to lose members of his own party, people who stood by have stood by him from the beginning, who voted for this law in the first place, start to really aggressively turn, that's going to be a huge problem for the law going forward.
Alexander Burns, where do you see Democrats moving around the president and the health care reform? Are they sticking with him in critical mass? Are they going to peel off? And if they do, what happens?
Well, so far, you do have most folks on that side hanging together. I do think the big, you know, the $64,000 question here is, what is the breaking point for Democrats? You know, is it we get to the end of November and the website still isn't fixed? Is it, you know, we get to January or February and there's still no substantive fix for the fact that people are unexpectedly losing their health insurance plans? Is it the middle of next year when we just see the midterm election polling, you know, turn in the wrong direction for the party and people start, you know, sort of heading for the hills? We don't know the answer to that, but we have seen a sort of not identical but analogous situation before with Republicans and the Iraq War during the 2006 election that the White House tried so hard during that two-year campaign to keep the party hanging together around a very controversial policy that was showing increasingly negative results. And what you ended up having was Republicans sort of fending for themselves in the final weeks of the election, and it clearly was not enough for them to keep the House of Representatives, the White House only really responding to the substance of the voters' complaints after the election was already over. That's the mistake that Democrats don't want to repeat here.
Let me go to Barbara in West Des Moines, Iowa. Barbara, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I don't understand why the radio, TV, and newspapers are not reminding people that insurance companies have always canceled anyone who used their policy if they thought they could get away with it. It's a matter of big business. That's one of the reasons for the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, I take your point, Barbara. It's true, and I've seen the numbers that insurance companies peel off lots of people quite regularly. And yes, indeed, that is a place where some Americans may now find coverage where they couldn't before. On the other hand, when those companies do that, it's in their contract that they can do it. The president, on the other hand, said this won't happen to you, and it is. Isn't that a difference, Barbara?
Well, the president is hardly in the insurance business.
Well, but he's the president of the United States leading the reform, and there he is, right on tape, saying, if you like your plan, you won't lose it. That wasn't true.
Well, it was as far as he knew. The insurance companies can do anything they want to.
They can do what's in their contract. He kind of made a deal. He apologized last night because he kind of broke it. On the other hand, Jack, I mean, Barbara's right. This is the case the president's making. Look, people were getting peeled off and left naked and on the side of the road, right and left, and this is supposed to address that. But it counts on Americans having the patience to wait for it to really come together. For this thing, the mechanics of the website, which is the number one path supposed to be to signing up, to get fixed, and to young and healthy Americans to think it's not such a big hassle that they're just going to avoid it. They need everybody in the pool.
In order to work, yes. You know, the Consumer Reports says of this individual insurance market that the president was apologizing for his misrepresentations about. Individual insurance is a nightmare for consumers. And the Obamacare, you know, it would reform that market, a market where the sick are charged more than the well, where women are charged more than men, and where the old pay often as much as three times as much as the young. All of that would be reformed under Obamacare, which would be a boon to people, even people who have coverage. But there is a fraction of such people, and they may be over a couple of million, who will pay more. They will get more, but they will pay more. And certainly even the 5 million, the president's representations left them out. And he just can't get around that. And, you know, that's sort of the second own goal here. I mean, the website, hard to believe this could happen like this. And then on top of that, this highly, you know, this completely anticipatable problem for which they didn't anticipate a solution, even a rhetorical solution. The president sort of falling on his sword and saying, well, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, clock ticking on that website repair. And as Alex Byrne says, everybody watching, Democrats very much included. More in Congress this week. Interesting, this debate and then vote in the Senate for a federal legislation that would protect gay rights in the workplace. Here was Iowa Democratic Senator Tom Harkin on Monday supporting the Employment Non-Discrimination Act on the Senate floor.
This is an historic opportunity for the Senate once again to say that we're all members of the American family. No one should be discriminated against because of race, sex, religion, national origin, and they shouldn't be discriminated against because of who they love or who they are, or whether they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered.
An impassioned Tom Harkin right there in the democratically dominated U.S. Senate, where that legislation has now passed. Of course, it has not passed in the House. Its fate there very much in doubt. On the floor of the yesterday, Indiana Republican, this was another Senator Dan Coats, looking across the aisle maybe, said he was concerned that the Employment Non-Discrimination Act could threaten Americans' religious freedom.
The legislation before us raises very serious concerns regarding religious freedom. The so-called protections for religious liberty in this bill are vaguely defined and do not extend to all organizations that wish to adhere to their moral or religious beliefs in their hiring practices.
Now, Casey, lay this out for me. I believe that this does not apply to religious employers. But he's still worried that it somehow would impinge on other people's religious beliefs here. Is that what he's pointing to?
The law does include some exemptions for both not just churches, but also religious affiliated institutions, potentially, excuse me, Catholic hospitals, things like that. Mm-hmm. They actually did make some adjustments to the religious liberty provisions of this bill at the request of Senator Rob Portman. It was an amendment that passed by voice vote earlier this week. And Portman, of course, came out in favor of gay marriage, revealing that his own son was gay. So what you saw this week was the last time that this legislation came up for a vote, it failed by one vote in the Senate. And this time around, 10 Republicans joined with Democrats to pass the legislation. And while you did see some people, Republicans, arguing against it, you showed Coates, House Speaker John Boehner says that he opposes it because of the lawsuits that it could potentially generate. He's using some of the arguments that the business community makes really regarding any new requirements that they would have to follow in employment law. You're not seeing sort of this overwhelming tide of fervor on the part of the right that we've seen in some past instances of this. I mean, it's really an indication of just how deep the sea change is on gay, lesbian, transgender issues. And the fact that people really didn't seem to want to step forward, you didn't see even the most firebrand of conservatives in the Senate, Senator Ted Cruz or anyone like that, stepping up to make a strong argument against this law. And now, of course, Democrats in the Senate are shifting their attention over to the House because Boehner has said he doesn't support it. It's unlikely to get a vote on the House floor, at least as a standalone measure. They're using that to portray Republicans as, you know, there were comparisons to references to the fact that the Republicans used to be the party of Lincoln and that this amounts to discrimination in the same way that blacks were discriminated against, people with disabilities were discriminated against. So that's kind of what the Democrats were setting up in part by passing this legislation now.
Let's go to Brooke in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Brooke, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to just speak from personal experience and knowing that I personally have kept my orientation in the closet due to the fear of repercussions that might happen within my organization.
You mean your workplace, Brooke? Do you mean, okay.
And so it's not really a reflection of even the people who are closest to me. I think that those people who work for me and even my immediate supervisor probably wouldn't care much, but there's a lot more factors involved in some organizations, such as board members, donors in my case, where you have individuals who are supporting the organization, that if an individual like myself in a position like mine might say, that I am gay, that it could have repercussions that would have a ripple effect throughout my organization.
So it sounds as though you would welcome this legislation in your case, Brooke.
I would, definitely. And not just for, my personal protection, but just knowing that I wouldn't feel comfortable in an interview or seeking out a new job, bringing up my personal life for fear of that causing me to not get a job.
Brooke, I'm very glad you called. Our time is short before the break, but I'm glad you called. Jack Beatty, there it is. I mean, you might think in this day and age this is unnecessary. In many states, it's already illegal to discriminate, but in many others, it's not. And there's Brooke saying, hey, I could use some cover here.
As Senator Harkin, in his opening speech, pointed out that 80% of Americans think it's illegal now. And, of course, we're wrong. I was one of them. If you had said, is it illegal to fire someone on the basis of sexual orientation? I'd say, of course, that's not legal. Well, in more than half the states, it is. And so, that was quite a moment, I think, just simply to find out the gap between what we think and what the world is really like. The other thing that struck me about this debate, and Casey touched on it, was the relative silence. For 2 days, the opposition didn't say a thing against this. You know, it was a one-sided mm-hmm. debate.
Yeah, yeah.
It was sort of like the prejudice that dare not speak its name. No one would come out
so
and
one
say
one hand clapping. Yeah.
Yes, and I think that's quite significant. In other words, people didn't feel it was defensible to come out and say, yes, you should be able to.
But Alex, very briefly, is this ever going to be law? The House doesn't look like it's moving on it. Is this Democrats putting House Republicans Tea Party over a barrel on this social issue again?
Oh, I think that's exactly what they're doing. You see them doing it on this. You see them doing it on immigration to gear up to make this a real social values and identity-based argument against the Republican Party that they just don't get America.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Toronto Mayor Rob Ford confirmed that a video apparently showing him smoking crack cocaine was in fact showing just that. He apologized in a press conference Tuesday and asked for forgiveness, understanding.
Yes, I have smoked crack cocaine. Wednesday. But no, do I? Am I an addict? No.
When have you smoked crack cocaine?
Probably in one of my drunken stupors, probably approximately about a year ago.
Oh, in a drunken stupor. That's fine. Bullying. In the NFL, Miami Dolphins lineman Richie Incognito suspended for harassing teammate fellow lineman Jonathan Martin. Dolphins coaches had reportedly asked Incognito to toughen Martin up. In a press conference Tuesday, Coach Joe Philbin was asked if he felt responsible.
I feel a responsibility for this entire workplace environment, atmosphere. And as a coach, your job is to help develop players, as football players, as people, as men.
And old school country music man George Strait, age 61, and just off his farewell tour, took surprise top honors at the Country Music Awards.
The CMA Award for Entertainer of the Year goes to... George Strait.
Well, 61 and going strong. We're talking about a week in the news, elections, Twitter going public, a gay rights bill, trans fats being shown the door. You can join the conversation. Do we need a new federal law to protect gays in the workplace? Did you get Twitter fever this week? How about that fierce new Pakistan Taliban leader who ordered the hit on Mulala Yousafzai? What about your thoughts on Toronto's mayor, on the NFL bullying story, Bullygate, on the end of trans fats, maybe your microwave popcorn? Can we just pause for a second here on the crack cocaine smoking mayor of Toronto? I mean, let's remember Washington, D.C., Marion Barry. I mean, we've had our own brush with all of this. But when you look across the border, Jack, and you listen to his kind of talking it out in public, is this another country, another culture on our doorstep? I don't remember being quite that way with Marion Barry.
No, I don't remember our Canadian friends showing such a tolerance for this, for this character. I mean, he's gone up 5 points, according to a piece I just saw, just since this latest news has come out.
A little like that London mayor with a big mop of hair in his sort of just, well, hey, here I am.
Ken Livingston.
I was drunk.
Yes, what right.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, it may be that there just is a feeling that, you know, vanilla politicians don't do it. We want a certain amount of entertainment in our public figures, and boy, does he provide entertainment.
We've got more to look at. We've got callers still on ENDA, on the gay rights in the workplace front. Michael in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Well, I'm calling because I think this law is absolutely necessary. I'm a tax-paying citizen and an American, and I'm transgender. And so that's my agenda. But I basically just wanted to say really quickly some things that have been misconceptions.
Okay.
By some Americans.
Yep.
Basically, as you know, we transgender people are not trying to take jobs away from non-transgender people. We're not trying to pose a threat to anyone's religious beliefs. And in fact, if your ideology excludes me, I probably don't want to work for you, you know. And we're not trying to expose children to negative influences. Basically, I just want to make the case that gender is an incredibly personal, private thing. And I'm not trying to impose my gender or my politics on anybody. But I'm a citizen of a country that prides itself on its human rights record, and this is a fundamental human right.
You put it very well, Michael, and we'll see how that message flies in the House of Representatives. But I appreciate your call and laying it out just that way. The House with this now on their plate, which means on Republican plates in the House. Bart in Des Moines, what do you think?
Here's my whole take on the situation is... The Republicans will never win an election, a national election, unless they change their policies. They haven't changed one policy since the 2008 election, and their party platform, if Chris Christie does get the nomination, he'll have to go so far right that America has changed, and they're not going to elect somebody with that strict of views. And that's all I'd like to say, and now I'll listen. Thank you.
Okay, I appreciate your call, Bart. I mean... well, there's Chris Christie, who's fairly liberal on a number of social issues, not on everything, but a party sort of having to listen to people who say, look, don't make me do this. And others looking at those polls, looking at the Constitution, as our caller Michael says, with their own views. I'm going to leave that one right there for now. We're going to hear more about this in the House of Representatives. I want to look for just a minute at the big Twitter IPO. Some people are very into this and others not in the least. But a lot of money on the line and a lot of the future of the internet and how we use it. On Thursday, in an interview with CNBC, Twitter CEO Dick Costolo said the company is experiencing continuous growth.
We've had consistent, tremendous growth across the world, frankly, for the last several years. Over 230 million monthly active users now.
But here's Brian Blau, Consumer Technology Research Director for the company Gartner, telling the AP that he doesn't know how it's going to go. Investors have to watch Twitter's performance over time.
Twitter really has to make sure they perform well. Quarter by quarter, they're going to have to show increases in user engagement and user growth. Twitter's going to have to show a move towards profitability and a reduction in the expenditures that they have.
Casey, Alex, I don't know which of you may be paying attention to this, but just the fervor over it. I mean, yes, there was a lot on Facebook, but I was also reminded going all the way back to the late 90s of how excited people were getting there. What did you make just of the degree of public hubba-hubba around Twitter's IPO, Casey?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Tom. One thing connected to this that I saw up on the Hill this week was there is so much excitement and fervor about this that the House Ethics Committee actually warned members of Congress against investing in Twitter. They said,
oh, keep your fingers out of the cookie jar, boys and girls.
Exactly. Members of Congress are subject to something that's called the Stock Act, which prohibits them from investing in companies that they have control over or potentially, you know, unduly benefiting from their public office in how they make money on the stock market. And they're not straight up prohibited from investing in Twitter, but they did say, look, the frenzy over this is so intense. And Twitter itself actively courts members of Congress in an attempt to get them to join the service, to use the service. So they essentially came out and said, be careful, you could be violating ethics rules if you put too much money down into this company in the wrong way.
But we've got a new set of billionaires this week and a couple of those founders. Alex, that always turns this country's attention. We're not done with that story of, holy smokes, look what they did.
No, I don't think we are. And you know, Tom, I'm old enough to remember MySpace and Friendster and these sort of social network companies that sort of seem like they pop and then peter out. And I think, you know, I'm a very active Twitter user. I think it's a great website. I'm not investing in the company. But I think it remains to be seen whether this is a model that's actually sustainable for a business. We have a whole number of these sort of social media companies that derive all their value from voluntary and uncompensated participation from people like the four of us on this show right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it remains to be seen whether that's really a way to monetize value and then pass that on to your shareholders.
Well, we'll see. For MySpace, there's a Google. For Friendster, there's a Facebook. I mean, these things can work and work big. They say they're driving toward it. Watch this space. Speaking of fingers out of the cookie jar and cookies, those partially hydrogenated fats that in the trans fats, the Food and Drug Administration this week saying they are going to be wrung out of our diet, that they're not going to be permitted. They're sort of unsafe at any speed, in any quantity here. Here's a teleconference yesterday, Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Margaret Hamburg saying studies have proven that trans fats, which we, many of us, have eaten a lot of for many years, are unsafe for human consumption. They're going to go.
The nonpartisan, much-respected Institute of Medicine independently concluded that trans fat provides no known health benefits and there's no safe level of consumption of artificial trans fat.
Jack Beatty, that took a long time. Think of how many tons of this stuff Americans have eaten over the years. I mean, you talk about what the government role should or should not be, but I don't know. This took at least as long as tobacco to get a little attention on the health front. This kind of serious attention, no more.
Feels like a lag, doesn't it? And Michael Bloomberg needs a lot of credit here. I mean, New York was ahead. I mean, they
remind people what he was onto there.
Well, he was onto trans fats. He put it on. They had to be put on the menu, and then it was banned in New York cooking. So if you wanted to eat healthy, you could go to New York City and there alone until now. And so he, you know, I think this is a legacy of his, and he broke it into public policy. And it is surprising that there has been this lag, but it may be that for the government to act, there has to be almost a universal consensus before they can go ahead. That is, everybody, science and you know, just common lore agree this is bad.
Glenn in Columbia, South Carolina. You're on the air, Glenn.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Pretty well. What do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting. It's like we all know and have known for decades that cigarette smoking is killing people like crazy. We know that alcohol does damage and has killed people not only in physically in their health,
but also kills people on the road. And now all of a sudden we're going to pass a law that says trans fats are no longer acceptable. It's confusing to me. Oh, doesn't that seem confusing to you?
Well, I mean, there are heavy taxes, certainly a lot of laws around tobacco now, a lot of laws around alcohol. I mean, I don't know. What do you think, Alex? If I really like my trans fat cookies, you know, should the government just stay the heck out of the way and let me have my heart attack?
Well, just as long as you're not drinking a soda that's over a certain threshold of size. But, you know, Tom, I think that we're going to have a big debate in this country on a number of fronts in the coming years about substance control. We have seen the government wage a really significant war on tobacco, not by banning it, but by through litigation against tobacco companies and, as you said, taxation. But, you know, on the one hand, you have folks like the Michael Bloombergs and Margaret Hamburgs of the world sort of cracking down on trans fats, trying to give people a lot of information about the negative health consequences of certain dietary decisions. On the other hand, you have a certain liberalization in the country around, it's obviously a very different kind of controlled substance, but certain kind of narcotics, marijuana, for the first time you have in the Gallup poll, a majority of Americans favoring decriminalization. So it does seem like if there's any kind of consensus on this range of issues, it's give people a lot of information, maybe impose some taxes to try and incentivize good behavior, and kind of get the police out of the way.
I mean, but I do think a lot of Americans who may not want a lot of government intervention in their life would still like somebody keeping track of the food supply so that it's not just plain killing us as the kids sit on the front porch eating some cookies. You want to think that is not a threat to their health. Maybe that's where we're headed right here. Jason in New Orleans. Thanks for calling, Jason. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just like to comment that I think it's great legislation because as a consumer, it's hard to get this information from the big food manufacturers and companies. And so I think the government has a role as a liaison to protect us and to help us get educated about what we're actually ingesting.
Yes.
So I think the legislation is great.
I guess this may not be legislation technically, but did the FDA moving on its own? It's interesting. I've heard diet experts saying this is going to change the American food supply. Those crackers and cookies that could sit in your cupboard for months and still be fresh when you open the package, that won't happen so much anymore without trans fats. Unless they come up with something else, we may have to get used to buying food more often, not keeping it around forever and a day. Trans fats were beloved by the food industry for a reason, and that the character now may be going away. Let's turn abroad for a second here. John Kerry has been very active in this week, talking with Israelis and Palestinians, also on his way to Geneva, thinking about maybe a deal with Iran. President Obama was thinking about that last night as he talked with NBC's Chuck Todd, saying he's willing to pursue an agreement with Iran on the nuclear front and more, that which would lead to some easing of international sanctions.
We don't have to trust them. What we have to do is to make sure that there is a good deal in place from the perspective of us verifying what they're doing and that they're actually moving in the right direction.
So there's the president of the United States. John Kerry may be headed toward some kind of agreement or work very close to it coming with the Iranians. The Israeli leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, last night in Israel, told a visiting delegation of U.S. lawmakers in no uncertain terms that the U.S. was making a big mistake in its negotiations with Iran.
I urge Secretary Kerry not to rush to sign, to wait, to reconsider, to get a good deal. But this is a bad deal, a very, very bad deal.
Well, most of us don't know what the deal is at this point. I don't know if the Israeli leader does either exactly. But, Alex, what's the sentiment you're feeling in Washington these days on a negotiated deal here with Iran? Is there support? Is there a lobby ready to block? How do you look at it?
You know, Tom, I think this is a place where everybody is still kind of finding their sea legs because certainly if there were some kind of deal that substantively, verifiably delayed Iran's ability to acquire a nuclear weapon, there'd be a lot of support for that. What's getting in the works a little bit is there's a real move on the Hill to impose new sanctions on Iran, and people are trying to figure out whether there's any way to advance that process that doesn't compromise the talks and vice versa. the big picture here, I think, is that people recognize that this is the administration doing what administrations do when they run into a lot of trouble with the Congress and domestic politics, which is go abroad. We see presidents do this all the time, particularly in their second terms. We saw Clinton do it when he ran into, obviously, a whole bunch of scandals, is get on a plane, go somewhere else, and try to get something done that doesn't need congressional approval.
But, Jack, we need this, don't we? I mean, Iran was on a path. Certainly, Benjamin Netanyahu said he held up the, you know, the sort of about to explode bomb there. It seemed like we need some kind of conversation with Iran, some kind of action on this. It doesn't seem entirely just diversionary.
No, and a six-month freeze in their nuclear enrichment program in exchange for an unspecified easing of sanctions. That sounds reasonable. You know, the president's big trouble here is with his own party. Senator Menendez, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, is leading the more sanctions. Even an oil embargo is being talked about. And, you know, congressional politics are, you know, the picture of the president having some freedom abroad. Yes, he does. But he's also constrained, and again we've seen, by congressional politics. It was congressional politics that took the Syrian option away from the president, couldn't do what he wanted there. And the shadow of interference here from Congress or congressional action on sanctions, that could really scupper a deal with Iran.
Well, watch this space. Secretary of State Kerry on the road today on that front. News all over. Of course, the drone strike killed the Pakistani Taliban leader, surely an American drone strike, and now his successor there, very brutal guy. You never know what the thing's going to be. This is the guy who ordered the attack, apparently, on Malala Yousafzai, the young Pakistani girl education activist. Down goes one, up comes another. History rolls on. It's been great to have all of you with us this hour. Alexander Burns, senior political reporter for Politico. Thank you very much for joining us today, Alex.
Thank you, Tom.
Casey Hunt with NBC. Thank you so much, Casey.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack, great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom.
Follow us online, onpointradio.org. I'm on Twitter, Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.